struts like John Wayne, resembles Jim Carrey, and dresses like he's visually impaired. Because he is. Insight with Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good Thursday morning. It's Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Ah, lovely day in New York City. Spring is in the air. There's nothing like the smell of spring. Yes, New York can actually smell beautiful. Can smell like buds blossoming. I love it. Can't get enough of it. Well, the Knicks are not feeling too good today. They are not in the playoffs. No. With a record like 17 and ready, 65, you're not going to the playoffs. That's the second worst season in franchise history. But you know, I was reading that they still do so well financially because think about the Garden. It's a legendary facility. Legendary. People from all over the world come there. And when you go there, two people are mostly occupying the Garden. Number one, tourists. And they pay a hefty price. And corporations, the suites, all the tickets. You look around, you can see people are coming right from work. So their ticket sales are still strong. So that has not hit their bottom line. Talent-wise, yes, they are in desperate need for a ramp-up. And they'll get that, obviously, with a bad season like that. We've got an incredible show coming your way. You're going to meet an exceptional gentleman named Kirk Adams. Kirk Adams is a president and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind. And their mission is to create a world of no limits for people who are blind or visually impaired. They mobilize leaders, advance understanding, and champion impactful policies and practices using research and data. We're going to meet Kirk in just a little bit. He's busy on one of his very, very cool technical devices that I would love to have. We'll get to maybe we'll do some video of that. We can actually get a tutorial from Kirk if he's up for it. So you may have heard about this. This is very, I don't know how to couch this. I guess it could have been disturbing, but it had a good ending. Middle school boys volleyball team. You heard about this in Fresno, California. We're going for a training run with their coach, and they were crossing a bridge. And what happened was they saw a woman standing on a ledge who waved to them. And they waved back, but then they realized, okay, she's probably in a moment of crisis. So one of the young boys, now we're talking 7th and 8th graders, 12, 13 years of age, had the wherewithal to run back to the coach. I guess this gentleman, this kid was in the lead, ran back to the coach and said, hey, coach, this is what's going on. He said, run back and talk to her. Keep her distracted. Now, there's so many things that are going through my mind. And as a coach, my first thing, and I don't want to second guess this guy because, you know, as an armchair person right now at this moment, you're going to do what instinctually you would do. And he did the right thing. He called the authorities. he's the adult, etc. But I imagine that it could have gone a different way. So let's go through the whole scenario and then we'll kind of retweak it, repick it up. So anyway, the boy goes back and gets together with the other boys and they start chanting, you know, come on, tell me that your life doesn't matter and I'll tell you how much it does. These are 12-year-old boys executing a chant. And this doesn't go on for 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 8 minutes. This goes on for 10 solid minutes. Now, 10 solid minutes when an adult, a 47-year-old woman, takes another step over the railing and is holding on by one hand. And there are 12 and 13-year-old, basically kids, trying to cajole her back to not die by suicide, to take her life. It's just unbelievable to hear and to kind of wrap my head around this. So, P.S., they succeeded. Unbelievable. They got there in time, obviously, in the nick of time. They practiced what they certainly were never prepared for just by the words of the coach to say, okay, keep her distracted. And before the authorities got there in a 10-minute span, she actually came back on the other side. That is just phenomenal to have the wherewithal to be so young. And to know this is not something that the coach said to them. This is something instinctually Now, looking at the picture of the boys who are, again, 12, 13 years of age, it looks like they're sort of in an urban environment. And maybe this is a testament to living in an urban environment. You become a little bit more resilient. And what do we all need more of in life? Resiliency. Kids need more resiliency, especially when I speak at schools. That's one of the hottest topics I cover, because we need to have coping mechanisms. No matter what comes down the pike in life, there's going to be issues. You're going to have life hardships. I mean, life is hard, you know, and everyone's going to have pain in their life, but no one has to suffer, right? Does that make sense, right? We all have pain, but you don't have to suffer. You have to ask for help. Like, we should all have a system of scaffolding in our life, a support system. And to look at these boys and to know they did such a brave thing, it's just tremendous. It's just a testament to, you know, sometimes we think, oh, someone's too young. Now, we would never want to place somebody in a situation that it's not an adult. Even an adult, this could be certainly a dicey situation, because, again, it could have gone certainly a different way. But the fact that they exercise something that they never probably had to really tap into before. But actually, I just thought of something else. Jesse, you can help me out here. Chime in. Is it, what's his name? Wade, who just retired, NBA player? Dwayne Wade. There was a commercial made by Budweiser the other day that aired, I think, on Tuesday night, that basically shows the turmoil this gentleman has overcome. And his mother is one of the final people that presents him with something that I'm going to try to do this justice, because I didn't read anything. I just saw the last few seconds of it. Basically, I guess she was involved with drugs. She went away. She did time in jail. And here's the son pulling the line, towing the line, rooting for her, doing everything he could in his power to get his mom clean, sober, and free. So here she is, you know, bowing to him and just giving him accolades, rightfully so. And she's not even talking about the basketball aspect of his life. She's just talking about the high principles this gentleman has. And he does so many things in a community in a quiet fashion. No glitz, no YouTube, no promoting it on social platforms. He just does what he thinks is the right thing to do. So going back to my story, is that so maybe these kids are used to hardships and used to things not being delivered, not having a privileged life. And so here they are trying to look at a Caucasian woman who I didn't see a picture of her. She's 47 years of old age. It doesn't matter what age you are in life. When you come through a situation of mental illness, whether it's depression, any of the things that you could have your brain chemistry off and ponder ending your life. And here they are, on the side of a bridge in the midst of a training run for their volleyball team, saving someone's life. Kudos to them. I just think that is just impressive on so many levels. And a total non sequitur here. Kim Kardashian, you know, reality star, influencer. Oh, my God. Yeah. Business mogul. I guess she is. She's all these things, right? And I'm sure there's a lot of other adjectives you can fill in there. And feel free to. I'll pause. But now she wants to be a lawyer. Yes, a lawyer. She wants to practice law. It's going to be interesting how she interprets law. But here's one little caveat here. She doesn't want to attend law school. I know you're saying to yourself, well, how can she become a lawyer? That's what I was thinking. Well, the reality is there is something that's been around since the 1800s. Actually, Thomas Jefferson actually utilized this. That you can actually be a reader of law. Sorry, 1760s. I was a little bit too late. It's called reading of the law. So you don't actually have to have a law degree. You can take the bar in four different states. California. And where are my notes here? Virginia. I want to say Washington State. And I thought there was one more. That's it. Those are the only states that allow you to not have a law degree where you can take the bar. Now, in California in 2015, out of 13,084 people who took the bar exam, there were three people that fall into that category. So it's obviously not an anomaly, but very, very rare. It's called Readers of the Law. So what happens is, obviously, she has to be able to pass the bar. Anyone who wants to take it in this particular state that doesn't require that, they have the law degree, they have to be able to pass the bar. And then after that, they have to basically have an apprenticeship with a lawyer who's currently practicing law. And each state has their own specifics in terms of how long they have to be an apprentice for. I would say you would think at least 3 years, three, 4 or 5 years, because law school, you know, we always hear a lot of funny things about law school. As a matter of fact, I just finished a great book about law school and how the there was kind of like a scheme by this one owner that had multiple law schools, and it became like a murder mystery and everything. But it was about the racket of how much they get charged. Anyway, a little sidebar there. But it's interesting to see that this can be done. And you know what? I have to take my hat off her. Good for her for trying to reinvent herself. And but when you read a line like when she says, Kim Kardashian says, you know, it's going really well. I got 100. And of course, you want to say like, I got 100 and I got 100. But she said there's a lot of boring reading. Yes, that comes with the, you know, law studying of, I almost said law degree, but that I would have been wrong. That's called case law. That's called reading about contracts, contractual law, criminal law. There's so many different aspects to it. Yes, I'm sure it's incredibly boring sometimes, incredibly tedious, but that's what you signed up for. So it's interesting also on the heels of what's been happening that broke, I guess, 3-4 weeks ago about the whole like college gate in terms of people taking exams for someone. Obviously, a little bit of a bribery to get someone into a particular school, college, university without the reflecting of grades that warranted someone being there. So it's kind of interesting timing. But, you know, good for her. It just shows that certainly that we're never too old or never too far removed, certainly, from doing something of this caliber. So it'll be interesting to see if she sticks with it. And how she does this, what's the actual end result? I smell a courtroom reality show. This reeks of that, right? I mean, I think there's like Judge Judy or something on TV right now, where there's a panel, a law courtroom of like three judges. I have no idea what it's called, but maybe that's where she wants to take it. I can't see her wanting to represent herself with her business activities, because you want somebody who's really immersed in that particular type of law, contractual law, et cetera, to speak on that behalf. Anyway, to be continued. I had a very interesting talk the other day at a college that unfortunately lost several students recently to suicide. They died by suicide. Very, very sad. It's actually not a big campus at all. Only about 3,000 total in attendance in terms of enrollment at this college. And it's they're kind of distraught, understandably so. So they actually got together a walk within like 6 weeks, put together a walk. And kudos to them for really having, I guess, the insight on many levels to gather so many obviously important people together. And first and foremost, the students that need to heal and have the camaraderie of loss, and also the hope that is essential for them to have. And so they came together on Saturday, and I was fortunate enough to be one of the speakers and kind of embrace the moment and the healing power and the optimism which comes with being in a rock bottom situation like this, and fill them with insight and positive belief that certainly no one has to suffer. There is help there, and pointed out certainly all the different reasons and outlets that are on campus right there. Privacy matters, certainly, in speaking to someone and speaking up when you know that somebody's in pain or in peril. It's very, very pivotal, whether it's someone that you're close to or a dorm roommate or whatever the case may be. But it's great to see that the college is handling this straight on. They're not dodging the bullet by any chance means. They're actually addressing it, because a lot of facilities and campuses and colleges across the nation sometimes have really dropped the ball. They feel like they're going to be towing the line and being responsible, culpable for any future suicides that possibly may happen. But I think that's not the way to go. I think you really have a responsibility for the health and welfare of them, the students being on your campus. Anyway, so I applaud the College of New Jersey, TCNJ, for doing a phenomenal job on every level. The looks of the faces of the students when I spoke and tried to evoke optimism, very responsive, and it couldn't have been a beautiful, more of a beautiful day. It was absolutely stunning outside, and the campus was glorious. So it was a home run all around, and looks like I'm going to be speaking at a few different sororities and a few fraternities there, as well as for the dean. And the president was there. And the president, not only did she do some opening remarks, not only did she actually walk it wasn't a long walk, maybe 2 miles or so. She hung around, spoke to everybody. And she was speaking to me. We were probably one of the last 10 or 15 people to leave. And she's speaking to myself and some other volunteers that were there. Parents actually that have a their child on campus there. And it was just really refreshing to see someone who's so entrenched and connected. And that made me feel really good about the fact that change is evident, and there's someone at the helm that really cares truly about every single student there. So the American Foundation for Blind champions access and equality and stands at the forefront of new technologies and evidence-based advocacy. AFB addresses the most pressing needs of people with vision loss and their families, breaking down societal barriers and promoting broad systematic change. Like Helen Keller, AFB's most famous ambassador, they are committed to creating a more equitable world for people with disabilities. It is my honor to welcome to the show Kirk Adams, President and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind. Kirk, how are you, my friend?
I am doing well. Great to be here in the city.
A little closer to that.
How's
mic.
That?
There you are. Yeah, welcome to New York City, my friend.
Absolutely.
So we were speaking before we went live today, and you said you're really not a fan of the subway system, and not because of delays, just because of the sheer numbers and the obstacle course slice junctures, correct?
Well, if I had grown up with the New York subway system, I know I would have found it wonderful. Can get anywhere in the city using it. I moved here to New York in May of 2016 from Seattle, and moved to Brooklyn. The AFB offices at that time were right next to Madison Square Garden at 2 Penn Plaza, right above Penn Station. So I have good mobility skills. I learned how to use a white cane when I was in first grade at the Oregon State School for the Blind. But navigating the F train to the A train from Brooklyn into Penn Station every day was my greatest mobility challenge. But I did learn how to do it. And
I'm sure you did.
I did it every day for 14 months.
Kirk, I wish you had grown up here, because if you did, you would be president of the MTA right now. And there's nothing more than what we need now is somebody with your skill set to lead that organization. Congratulations on mastering that task. And that's a tall order to order, that's for sure. So vision loss at the age of 5.
Correct.
So that's something obviously you don't recall, because obviously that was a couple years ago, even though you look darn good. It's something that you envisioned was like an ocean and more of a nature-esque sense in terms of your recall?
Yeah. So I was born a sighted child and lived as a sighted child till I was in kindergarten, and both of my retinas detached. And I'm of a certain age that was before laser surgery. So if that happens to a kid today, there's a great chance that his sight can be preserved. But in my case, I became totally blind very quickly, within a few weeks, and went to a school for blind children, as kids did in those days, before laws were passed to give children with disabilities the right to education in their neighborhood school. But I don't remember colors, but I remember some spatial things. We lived in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. I can remember like the images of the ocean, the beach, trees, mountains, those types of things have stuck with me.
Well, those are nice, subtle images to be able to conjure up from time to time. Well, you know, it's interesting. When I speak to persons with disabilities and students, youth, I say to them, listen, nobody wants to have a disability, but there's never been a better time to have a disability with the technology that exists. And here you are now at the helm at AFB, American Foundation for the Blind, and you're making and instituting great change. The programmatic change in terms of giving opportunities, employment, et cetera. So I want to touch on some of those opportunities because I know those are near and dear to your heart. Blind Leaders Development. Speak about that, please.
Sure. So that's a program we'll be starting this summer. And when we look at systems change, we look at key influencers, we look at decision makers, what information do they have, what knowledge do they have, what experiences do they have, and we believe that in order to create a more inclusive world for people who are blind, that's the group we're concerned with.
Mm. Not the Kardashians.
If Kardashian becomes visually impaired, we're right there.
Well, all that reading may give her blindness, yes.
So we believe that having more blind people with the lived experience of blindness in leadership positions will facilitate systems change, identifying barriers to inclusion and creating more inclusive environments. So when we say blind, we mean legally blind. So there's 24 million people in the country that have a visual impairment. Most people who are legally blind are not totally blind, like I am. Most people who are technically legally blind have some usable vision. And a lot of people, especially older folks, don't identify as blind. They may say, I can't read the newspaper anymore, and I can't drive anymore, but I'm not blind. So our concern is for people whose visual condition impacts the way they live.
Absolutely. And we should articulate that being legally blind is 20/200 or worse in your corrected eye.
Yes, or a visual field of less than 20 degrees.
So that's a fair amount of people, certainly, that we serve and that fit that realm of visual acuity.
Right. So Blind Leaders Development, we will have an application process that will start in the fall. We'll bring in a cohort every year. We're thinking 16 blind and low vision individuals who have a desire to increase their capacity to serve in leadership roles. We've decided on a curriculum. It's called the Leadership Practices Inventory. It was developed by Kuzis and Postner. And they interviewed thousands and thousands of leaders and asked them to describe their best leadership experience. And from those interviews, they discern that there are universally five behaviors that great leaders exhibit. And they've developed an inventory with six subcategories. There's a way for people to self-test to get a sense of where they think they are as a leader. You can do a 360, have other people chime in, and you get a picture of where a person is at on that leadership journey. And then there are steps to take to help folks strengthen their leadership capabilities.
That's fascinating. And I want to divert for a second, Kirk, because it was one book actually that changed your professional route, trajectory in life. What Color is Your Parachute?
Right.
And it's interesting when you talk about what you just mentioned, vital decisions in terms of decision-making, becoming a leader, et cetera. And here you are at the helm at the AFB years later. Interesting.
Yeah. I guess I tend to go to the academic. My parents were teachers. I guess I always think someone wrote a book about this somewhere. I will find it and gather their wisdom that they put down.
Well, now that you finish your doctorate degree, you have time to write a book, or maybe not right now. Let's just bask in the solace.
Give me a few months of rest.
So yes, exactly.
I did finish my doctorate last month in leadership and change. So
congratulations.
I have a PhD in leadership and change from Antioch University. It took me 8 years. We did move from Seattle to New York and from New York to Virginia over the last 3 years, but I kept chipping away at it and wrapped it up. I did an ethnographic study of blind adults who are successfully employed in
what
large...
What kind of study is that, Kirk?
Ethnographic.
Ethnographic, okay.
Ethnographic study, of which is basically qualitative. It's interviewing. It's talking to people. It's having conversations. So I had long conversations with a number of blind individuals who self-identify as successfully employed in large American corporations. So people work at Google and Microsoft and AT&T and Siemens and places like that. Some people totally blind, some with a lot of usable vision. Some people who are new in their careers, some people who've been with their company for 40 years. And what we find is that the people who are in those positions are definitely the exceptions rather than the rule.
Mm-hmm.
They all had vast struggles to get where they are. And we look at the employment numbers. Working age blind adults are in the labor force at about half the rate of the general population. And the range of occupations is much narrower than the general population. Salaries are lower, and that cascades into lower home ownership and greater rates of poverty and all those things.
Et cetera, et cetera.
But what we want to do at AFB is understand how successful folks got there, what systems did they have to fight through, what obstacles did they have to overcome, and let's do something about removing those obstacles so the next blind person who comes along has an easier path. So I talked to lots of parents of blind kids. My parents were parents of a blind kid. They had never met a blind person in their life before my retina's detached. And most parents of blind children don't know blind people, have seen no successful role models. There's a lot of emotion, a lot of fear. And
a lot of protecting, I imagine.
Yes, and they want to know what can my child's life look like? And we want to be able to say your blind child's life can look a lot like your sighted child's life.
Absolutely, yeah.
they should be doing the same mm-hmm. things. When your sighted child's out playing in the playground and skinning their knees and
sure.
tussling in the sandbox,
pretty much
blind,
mirror each
your
other.
Blind yeah. child should be doing that.
Yeah. Kirk, question for you: with that mm-hmm. study you just cited,
yeah.
is there a median age?
Oh, in my research.
Correct, because I want to find out if the professionals with vision loss who are much older. So their experiences are obviously going to be
oh,
different.
Oh, no. I intentionally looked at a range. So the youngest person was in their mid-20s.
Oh, great.
And was working at a major software company as a program manager. The oldest person had retired from a big industrial manufacturer.
So I'd
say the medium age was probably around 40.
So with all that content yeah. and all that wisdom and knowledge at your fingertips, and that's, I guess, how you came up with the idea to have the Employment Summit, because you have contacts
right.
with Google
yeah.
And other incredible big organizations where it's not only vital for them to learn more about people with vision loss, but them to realize how much capability and prospective employees that they are not tapping into.
Yeah, it's very interesting. When we talk to employers, they say they want employees who are really good at working in teams, really good at working with all kinds of different folks, really good at creative problem solving, at analyzing and managing risk. And living as a blind person gives you a chance every day to hone those types of skills. So we believe, for those corporations who want to look at difference as an asset, that want to bring in people with all different kinds of tools into their organization, all different kinds of experience, our concept is that employing people who are blind can really give an employer a competitive advantage by tapping into a pool of experience, knowledge, passion that is really underutilized.
And from my experience, all the people I've interviewed with disabilities throughout the years is that the work ethic is incredible, typically.
Yeah, well, having a severe disability, which blindness is it's like having a second full-time job. There are complications. You have to learn additional skills. There's a concept called the expanded core curriculum as a good example that AFB helped develop. It's for blind children, for students. So the blind kid has to learn everything the sighted kid learns in school and 9 additional things, how to travel independently using a cane, how to use their technology, whether it's braille or speech or magnification, how to advocate for themselves, how to work with their teachers and their parents to craft their individual education program, their IEP. So kids with disabilities have to learn extra stuff. Adults with disabilities have to approach things in a in a creative, systematic way. And again, we believe the results of all that experience is a really well-rounded person with a lot of skills.
Absolutely. And we were talking about resiliency a few minutes ago. It certainly makes you very, very resilient. And you mentioned the word creative. Persons with disabilities are extremely creative because they have to be. Because sometimes they don't have someone to do X, Y, or Z for them. How do I accomplish this? How do I get this done? How do I get to the F train, et cetera? So you become very creative. Kirk Adams is my guest today. He's the president and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind. Their mantra is expanding possibilities for people with vision loss. I'll talk about the leadership conference because I know this is something that's vital to AFB's organization.
Yeah. So we have an annual leadership conference, and actually, I attended my first AFB leadership conference in 2001. I had been hired by a blindness organization in Seattle, the Lighthouse for the Blind. I hadn't worked in the blindness field. I'd been in banking and finance for my first chapter out of college. And the person who hired me said, if you want to get to know the blindness field and the issues, you need to go to the AFB conference. So I went to the first one in D.C. I never missed. I went every year. Now I'm privileged to be able to host it as the president and CEO. So it's really an opportunity to bring stakeholder groups together across sectors who have common interests in creating more inclusive world for people who are blind. So we do have employers there, our friends at JP Morgan Chase, Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, et cetera, et cetera. We have the federal agencies there who have the mandates to create opportunities for people who are blind.
Terrific.
People from the Department of Education, Department of Labor. We have academic folks there, researchers who are doing research in the blindness field. We have CEOs of nonprofits who serve people who are blind in various ways. And then we have lots of blind people, lots of successful, active blind people. And we facilitate dialogue, and we try to accomplish things at our conference.
Absolutely. Now, the companies that you mentioned, is that a result of your establishing relationships with them and inviting them to this conference?
Yeah. So AFB was founded in 1921 here in New York, did the smart thing and hired Helen Keller in 1924. And she worked for AFB until she passed away in 1968. And AFB is very unique. We're a private nonprofit. We have just a really broad charter that says, improve the lives of blind people in America. And we get to decide what that means at any given time. But AFB was very early on involved in technology and engineering, developed some of the first voiced technologies, some of the first talking bathroom scales and talking blood pressure monitors. And then when companies started thinking about accessibility, many of them reached out to AFB Tech for input. So we have had wonderful and continue to have wonderful relationships with the corporate community in lots of different sectors. And the environment has really changed noticeably over the last, I'd say, 5-10 years, in that companies are starting to view inclusion of all kinds of people, including people with disabilities, including people who are blind, as a important business strategy. So people are talking about inclusion and accessibility at levels that we hadn't seen in the past. Companies are putting resources, staff, and money into creating inclusive environments at levels we haven't seen before. So it's very, very encouraging.
Yeah, it's being more representative, as I'm sure you have heard. Television commercials is a great example. Obviously, Hollywood has a long way to go, L.A., in terms of more inclusivity. We read about this all the time. But, you know, you see Swiffer commercials with a gay couple, a person in a wheelchair. I mean, it runs the gamut. So that is not ubiquitous, but it's not an anomaly anymore. And it's great to see representation. Now, you mentioned all those different components to AFB in terms of people reaching out. Corporations or companies looking and seeking advice. And another component to AFB is AFB Consulting. And obviously you realize, well, you know what? We are the source, so let's make a component of this.
Yeah, so it's a social enterprise. It's a business, and we generate revenue while we're making a difference and creating more inclusive environments. And that really came out of those relationships. where some of our corporate friends would ask us to come in and give them some advice on something, some
input. So you literally go into someone's confines office and...
Yeah, and then we said, how about you pay us for this advice?
Yeah.
So we do have a consulting practice, and although progress has been made and great strides have been made, there are still... many barriers to inclusion, many parts of our digital environment that are not accessible to people who are blind. So we don't go into a partner's business and find the problems and fix them. We help them understand how to analyze their own environments, understand what they need to do, teach them how to fish, so to speak, rather than handing them a fish.
Mm.
So we want to go in, help establish the processes, understand what their folks' training needs to be so that they can create accessibility in their environments.
Kirk, in a macro sense, is this both a mindset and a financial consideration?
Well, there's a couple of drivers. Probably the biggest initial driver was compliance with law, and the laws.
Oh
were
yeah,
passed
that too.
That, yes, the laws around telecommunications being accessible, around television program being accessible, the ADA, of course. So many of these companies started thinking about accessibility because they wanted to be in compliance with the law. So that was kind of the first wave of hiring accessibility folks, and that was a risk management, legal compliance driver. I'd say the next driver was the market. You know, there are 54 million people with disabilities, something like that, in the United mm-hmm. States with combined spending power. One of the largest, air quotes, minority groups as far as spending power goes. So I think the next kind of driver was, hey, let's make it easier for people with disabilities to purchase our products. Let's understand what their needs are, how they need to manage the purchasing process. Let's not create barriers between them and sales. And now I think the next wave is really, again, thinking about inclusion in the workforce and the talent scramble. All employers are looking for talent. There's great competition for talent, and there's, in our case, large numbers of people who are blind and visually impaired with a lot of talent who just have not connected with the world of work. Mm.
And Kirk Adams, this is all too familiar to you, because when you graduated college, top of your class, you could not get a job. Or if you went for interviews, it didn't go too well, and then you told me that you would put in your cover letter that you were finally, you just put it out there. A spade is a spade. You're visually impaired, you're blind. And then that didn't work either.
Yeah, so I graduated with a bachelor's degree in economics, and I did well academically. I Phi Beta Kappa and cum laude and those types of honors, which look good on a resume. And I was applying for jobs. The IBM Selectric with erase tape was the hot technology. So I typed my cover letters. And,
love it.
And
analog. That's the way to go, Kirk.
Typed my resumes and went down to the copy store and got them copied. And
yeah.
So I'd send them out. I would get a phone interview. It would go well. I'd be asked to come in for an in-person interview. And I'd walk in with my white cane and my Braille. And ultimately, I would not be offered a position. Oftentimes, employers who don't have experience working with people with a disability can't conceptualize how a person with a disability could perform the duties of the job. There's a lot of kind of ungrounded fears and concerns.
Though I'm sure they showered you with accolades because they couldn't believe how much you've accomplished in your life being blind.
Right, right. And then, one of the questions people with disabilities have to ask and answer for themselves is at what point in the employment process do you disclose that you have a disability? So after a number of those experiences, I like you said, I decided to just put it up front in the cover letter. Said, I'm totally blind. I have been since I was 5. Here's how I do my work. Here's the tools I use. This is the technology I use. Here's how I will do the job that I'm applying for. And then I wasn't getting phone interviews. So I've had that lived experience of the barriers to employment that many blind people face.
So then it was the nonprofit sector that I thought, I believe that you realized that could be your calling because you were able to create a niche for yourself.
Yeah, well, there was a 10-year period there. I sent out one of my cover letters and resumes. I started casting my net wider and wider. I'd been accepted to graduate school. I decided I wanted to work. I wanted to earn a paycheck. I wanted to get married and have kids and take on a mortgage and do all those things that young adults do.
All those rite of passage things, sure.
Right, right. So I had sent a resume and cover letter to a small family-owned brokerage firm in Seattle that underwrote and sold tax-free municipal bonds. The sales manager had gone to my same college, was also an econ major, maybe 15 years before me. He called some of the professors that we both had, and they said, oh, sure, he could do that job. So I was a licensed securities broker for 10 years, and I sold tax-free municipal bonds over the phone, straight commission, 50 cold calls a day every day. Build strong character.
That'll, yeah, definitely. Woo!
And then I pivoted to the nonprofit sector, and yeah. I entered it through becoming a professional resource development person, a fundraising person.
When you look back at that time, is it a blur, or is it something that kind of motivates you to, obviously, to accomplish more of the goals that you set out for yourself today?
Well, that was, you mentioned What Color Is Your Parachute, and that's where that book entered in. After 10 years in the securities industry, the firm I was with was purchased by a major commercial bank. Things were changing. I chose that time to reflect upon what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, and I determined one thing. I didn't want to continue doing what I was doing.
Was your vision a consideration in terms of your doing? Were you successful?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you were successful?
Yeah, yeah.
In the brokerage firm?
Yeah,
and now you're thinking about...
I did those things. I been married for 33 years. Our kids are grown. We still own the house in Seattle that we moved into at that time of our lives. So,
was it daunting for you in terms of considering a new change and path?
It was, but I had been successful enough financially that I had a bit of a cushion. If we lived very, very frugally, we could probably go a year. And I was 30 years old, had the kids, and I thought, I'm going to work for another 35, 40 years. I better find something I really enjoy. So the What Color Is Your Parachute book in Braille, from the Talking Book in Braille Library, went through every step, every page, did every little exercise, and came out at the end with clarity that I wanted to be in the nonprofit sector. I wanted to work for an organization that helped knock down barriers faced by people who are blind, and I wanted to be in a management or a leadership role.
And when we think about assistive technology, just think about one little major aspect in your life that turned into a whole different life for your wife and your family and all the people that you impact. If that book was not available on tape.
Right.
Or in Braille.
Right. Yep.
That little nuance right there could have set you on a whole different trajectory.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And part of the process, once you decide what kind of job you want, is to talk to people who are doing it. So I set up interviews with some CEOs of nonprofits in Seattle that I respected, and actually the CEO of Planned Parenthood of Western Washington had also been a securities broker, and she strongly urged me to enter the nonprofit sector through fundraising. She said, you've spent the last 10 years of your life talking with people about
money
every day.
Sure, no brainer.
And there's a great need for professional resource development people. So serendipity plays a great part in my journey. I started applying for fundraising jobs. I wasn't getting them because I didn't have experience. But I got a newsletter from that same Talking Book and Braille Library saying we have to raise $200,000 or close down one of our programs. And I called the librarian, whom I'd known for years, because I'm a big Braille library user. And I explained my situation to her, and I said, how about I come down and volunteer 20 hours a week and help you raise this money? That'll give me something on my resume. I'll job hunt the rest of the time. So went in, ordered a book on cassette tape, recorded by volunteer at Recording for the Blind, which is based in New Jersey.
Love it.
And got a book on how to write a grant proposal on tape, listened to it, had a volunteer, library volunteer, read me the Washington State Trust Directory, sent letters of inquiry, was given the opportunity to submit some grant proposals, had some beginner's luck, some checks came in, and they...
So you flourished.
Yeah, they created a job for me. So my first nonprofit job was a development officer for the Seattle Public Library Foundation, raising money for the state talking book and
well,
library.
As president and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind, I mean, to be fiscally savvy is certainly, and to have development on your belt is a huge plus.
Yeah, no money, no mission.
Yeah,
you have to steward resources. So, American Foundation for the Blind has been the very grateful recipient of philanthropy since our founding in 1921. So we have tens of thousands of people who share our interest in creating a world of no limits for people who are blind, who donate to AFB. And we have been left in many wills and estates over the decades. I will tip my hat to Ms. Keller. Helen Keller was a fabulous fundraiser, and she was a great driving force behind the philanthropy that has supported AFB over the years. So when someone, other day we got a $20 bill in the mail from an elderly lady in Denver, Colorado, who said, I want to make sure that the people who are blind have a fair chance. And when we get that $20 bill, it's our job to use it wisely and
well,
to maximize our impact.
About the work that you're doing, that someone just, I mean, obviously, that $20 does a lot for them. And they decide to put it in an envelope and send it to AFB. That speaks volumes.
Yes, it does. And I one great part of my job is calling people to say thank you for their support. And almost everyone has something in their heart connected with people who are blind. So it may be there's a blind family member. They had a college roommate who was blind. I talked to a gentleman who was a retired federal judge, and he said the gentleman who sold the newspapers in the courthouse was blind, and I bought a paper from him every day for 40 years. Some people saw the film The Miracle Worker when they were in grade school. So there's a connection and a belief that it's equity and justice. It's if you look at society, and of course we focus on people who are blind and visually impaired, but as a society, we need everybody to be able to contribute. We need everybody's talent,
all
everybody's passion,
deck.
All
yes,
hands
absolutely.
On deck. And if we have created barriers that prevent society bringing people into the circle, we need to understand what those barriers are and get rid of them.
The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. So pleased to be speaking with Kirk Adams, President and CEO of the American Foundation for the Blind. On the heels of that statement, Kirk, do you think our government does enough for persons with disabilities in this country?
Well, the short answer is no. There's a lot more that can be done. I'll give you an example. And funding underlies much of this, but there's a program under the Department of Education Rehabilitation Services Administration called the Older Individuals Who Are Blind program, and it's to help blind and low vision people who are 55 or older either gain or maintain their employment. And the budget for that program for the entire United States is $33 million. It's apportioned by population. So a state like Wyoming is getting $180,000.
Wow.
So funding is the most obvious one. There's been continual legal attack on the Americans with Disabilities Act. Mm-hmm. Those protections are always under pressure. Again, I think it's a matter of equity, inclusion. Our focus, obviously, is people who are blind and visually impaired, but we're part of a larger community of people with all types of disabilities. And a dollar spent on creating a situation where a person can be gainfully employed, where they can remain living independently, the return on investment is clear and documented.
Absolutely, sure.
So again, it's a matter of understanding where the leverage points are, understanding which laws, which acts of Congress, which administrative regulations really are creating barriers, and those that can be changed to create greater opportunity. So that's another part of what we do, is understand the public policy landscape.
With the ADA being over 25 years of age, do you think and wish it could be revisited in terms of being a little bit more current, and obviously with the technology that exists nowadays and what we've learned and accomplished in the last 25 years?
Yeah, so I guess the most obvious example there is when the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed. We didn't live in the digital environment we do now. So when the law talked about public accommodations and people being able to, for instance, enter a public building, they were thinking about wheelchair ramps, as an example. How can a person get into a building? But now much of our world is not in a building. It's online. It's on a website. It's part of the internet. So if a person with a disability, a blind person, for instance, if the website isn't designed correctly, it's like a building with a steep staircase for a person with a wheelchair.
Sure.
So there has been some encouraging cases recently heard that have indicated that at least some courts are understanding that the accessibility has to go beyond the physical environment to the digital environment. But yes, it would be... It would be a wonderful thing to take the law and map it against our current and our future environments. When we talk to our friends at Google and Apple and those types of forward-thinking organizations, they're talking about virtual reality and artificial intelligence and technologies that are emerging that we really need to understand as well, because we want to make sure those new technologies are designed so that blind people can benefit from them rather than creating a new set of barriers.
It's in a very exciting time, I think, Kirk. Don't you believe in terms of being at the forefront of technology? We mentioned that before in terms of how it makes all of our lives a bit easier. Speaking of websites, AFB.org has a new look.
We do.
It's easy to navigate, and obviously you have to be. I mean, this is the pillar of accessibility here, and a job well done, and I advise you to check it out, our listeners, afb.org. And, of course, there's a donation section.
Yeah, and it
take it away, Kirk.
Yeah, it outlines what we're working on, and if you would like to be part of what we're doing, please reach out. You can... We'd obviously love a donation, but we'd also love even more a conversation to understand what your interest is, to be in touch, to talk about what we're doing. And we're a small organization. We're very virtual. We have people across the country. Everything's in the cloud. We're trying to understand what the 21st century workplace will look like for people who are blind, and to lead the way in creating an inclusive work environment. So the website just launched last week, the relaunch, so afb.org. And
it's interesting.
Love to have you visit.
You mentioned the word conversation, because how many people are listening to this program who work for a company that could use someone like X, Y, or Z, and that you have the connections to people in this realm, in this waiting area, that are underemployed? And that's actually a dovetail perfectly timed. I've been up since 4 o'clock in terms of my next question. For someone who is blind and visually impaired, if they're not connected into a web of maybe social media groups, et cetera, looking for jobs, et cetera, how would someone, besides doing the typical job search, get connected with a Microsoft or a Google?
Well, I think you need to build a broad network. That is something I didn't have when I came out of college. My parents were teachers. Their friends were teachers. Everyone I knew was a teacher, and that wasn't what I wanted to do. So I didn't have
Seems like it paid off for you.
I didn't have a business network or much understanding of business.
It was a different model, right?
So I would recommend that that a blind person do multiple things. There is, in each state, a vocational rehabilitation agency that is funded by the Department of Education, whose purpose is to facilitate employment for people who are blind. You're very familiar. You sit on an advisory committee of one of those agencies, I know. And they should think about the two large membership groups, the National Federation of the Blind, the American Council of the Blind. They have chapters in every state and many cities. And go find them. They will. Both organizations will welcome you with open arms to a meeting. You can taste the flavor and see how that works. Also, I think some of the indicators of companies that you, if I was counseling a young blind person or the parents of a young blind person, I would say get on the websites, look at their diversity and inclusion statements, find out if they specifically call out disability as one of their focus areas. That's a really good sign.
And use that as a foothold.
That's a good sign. Yeah. And then find out if they have an employee resource group that focuses on disability. That's another really good sign.
Great point.
And I would call and ask for an informational interview with someone who's part of the employee resource group. I would say, that's what I did. I'd say, hey, I'm really, really interested in how blind people work in your organization. Could I have an opportunity to come and speak with someone? So call HR.
Get that door open.
Call HR.
Get your foot in the door.
That's
You're going to have to leave it right there. Kirk Adams, President and CEO for the American Foundation for the Blind, expanding possibilities for people with vision loss. Their website is afb.org, afb.org. Kirk, I can't thank you enough for your time and your insight on such a vital mission that you've been driven and all through your life in terms of how many people you've impacted as a role model, and I know that you don't do it to serve as a role model, but what opportunities you're creating for countless people.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much as well for listening. This is Insight. Catch me every Thursday right now. Of course, this show can be found on the Insight page. Gary Null is next. Gary Null, the founder and creator of the PRN Network. Thanks so much to Jesse and Alex. My name is Mark Farrell. Have a great day.
Insight with Mark Farrell. Check out this and all Insight shows on the Insight page at PRN.FM. PRN.FM. Have Mark speak at your company, your kids' school or college. Mark speaks on critical topics that affect kids and adults everywhere, from anti-bullying, mental health, drugs, and alcohol to overcoming adversity. Visit MarkFarrellMotivation.com for more info. Insight, Thursday mornings at 11.